fans, this is your eyes and ears of the Press Box, Biff Burns, with another guest here in the Biff Burns Sports Room. We're going to chat with Wilbur V. Dodson. Wilbur, I understand that you're ready to play a long shot by putting still another new professional sports franchise here in New York.
Well, I don't really feel that I'm playing a long shot, Biff. This city has indicated that soccer is really beginning to catch on here. So I have every reason to believe that the good people will turn out to support my New York Kangaroos.
Well, from our vantage point here in the sports room, we certainly wish you the best of luck, Wilbur. But I know a lot of critics are saying that the abundance of foreign-born players is one of the things that's hurt pro soccer in this country. And from the nickname of your team, I assume the Kangaroos are mostly Australians.
Well, that's only partially true, Biff. Some of the guys were born down under, but quite a few of them are second and third generation Americans of Australian descent.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. But I assume it means that the names of some of your team members are already familiar to U.S. fans, then.
Well, I'm afraid I don't exactly know what you mean, Biff, but taking your question literally, my players obviously don't have names at all. It's not customary to, you know, give names to kangaroos.
Well, I think you may have just dropped the season's biggest bombshell here in the sports room without realizing what you've done, Wilbur. Are you trying to say that your players are really kangaroos, and that's not just a team nickname?
That's right, but I don't know what you find so unusual about that, Biff. I realized as soon as Paley, is that how you pronounce his name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Had been signed by another team, that he's really the only human soccer player whose name means much in this country at all. So I figured I might as well go for raw talent instead of name value. And, of course, that meant kangaroos.
So you put a whole team under contract.
Well, actually, I already had them under contract. I was planning to use them on a new team I was getting together for the World Football League. But then the WFL folded, as you know, before we could play our first game.
Well, from our vantage point here in the sports room, we certainly extend our condolences on that costly bit of bad luck, Wilbur.
Well, I think it probably was all for the best, Biff. I found out at our training camp that kangaroos don't play football as well as you might think. Of course, you know, they can kick field goals from just about any place, but their front paws are too short to mount much of a passing attack. Also, they fumble a lot when they try to run a, you know, a running game.
Well, I don't imagine there'd be much spectator appeal in a football team that just kicks field goals on first down every time it gets the ball.
Well, that was my feeling exactly, Biff. So, from a purely personal standpoint, I think it may have been a good thing that the WFL folded so I could convert the Kangaroos into a soccer team.
Yes, soccer is more of a purely kicking game, that's true. So I guess a trained kangaroo might be able to adapt to it more easily.
Yes, there's no doubt about that. The guys still have a tendency to step on each other's tails, you know, when the flow of play suddenly moves from one end of the field to the other, but they can really kick the ball on the rare occasions when one of them decides he wants to. They can really kick them good.
Well, I think you may have just let another bombshell slip out there, Wilbur. You're trying to say that the kangaroos don't particularly care about kicking a soccer ball, even though they're playing on a soccer team?
Well, that's right. But you got to remember one thing, Biff. They don't know they're playing on a soccer team, so there's no reason for them to want to kick the ball. However, I'm hoping to spray the ball with, I don't know, catnip or something like that to attract their interest.
Well, I'm sure that'll make the team more of an offensive scoring threat, Wilbur.
Oh, well, you better, Will. Even now, when one of them happens to kick the ball accidentally, it almost always goes clear over the roof of the stadium where we're practicing.
Well, and they certainly have the natural talent,
yes.
Do they ever kick the ball into the goal?
No. Just over the roof of the stadium. They don't know they're supposed to kick it into the goal. That's, you know, a pretty complicated thing to teach a kangaroo.
Well, I know you'll be out there trying to teach them to do it right, up to the day you go bankrupt, Wilbur, so thanks for dropping by to tell us about your idea. This is Biff Burns saying until next time we get together in the sports room. This is Biff Burns saying so long. And again, it's time for Bridget Hillary and the News, the exciting but frequently dramatic story of a girl radio reporter who dares to tell the truth in her hard-hitting weekly broadcast. As our scene opens today, Bridget is in the rehearsal room of the Amalgamated Broadcasting System. Her young son, Blodgett, by a previous marriage, is just entering.
Why, Blodgett, what are you doing here? School bus should have dropped you off at home hours ago.
I have to walk the whole 6 miles now, Mom. I'm ashamed to face our school bus driver since you reported on your program that the buses are all controlled by the Mafia. He even said the drivers are forcing kids to hand over their nickels and dimes as protection money.
2 minutes to airtime, Mr. Horry.
You made our driver so mad he threatened to make me ride in the seat over the back wheels, even though it nauseates me.
Well, I was afraid the mob might threaten you with violence, Blodgett. But I'm sure they wouldn't dare to lay a finger on the son of a prominent reporter like myself.
Well, I'm not really scared of having Mr. Schlumberger lay a finger on me, Mom. He's almost 80 years old. I could probably flatten him if I had to. But he still makes me wait on the sidewalk until the seats are all filled, except the one over the back wheel.
1 minute to airtime, Miss Hillary.
Boss, I can't say I blame him. If anybody believed your story, he could be fired. He's been driving the bus for that school since way back when it was pulled by horses.
Well, if he's been operating his shakedown racket for that long, then I think it's high time he was put behind bars where he belongs. In 50 years, his illegal activities could easily have netted him $1 million tax-free. I must remember to mention that staggering figure on my broadcast tonight.
Oh, gee, I sure wish you wouldn't say anything like that about Mr. Schlumberger, Mom. He's already upset about having to live in a tar paper shack down by the dump. If you claim he's got a cool million stashed away, he'll be mad enough to make me ride over the back wheels forever.
You're on the air, Miss Hillary.
And my nausea from bouncing around back there could become a permanent condition.
Well, Blodgett, you know how it hurts me to watch you suffer. But as a responsible journalist, I can't stand by and let ruthless gangsters like Mr. Schlumberger get away with extortion. You told me yourself that he shook you down for 15 cents just last week.
That wasn't a shakedown, Mom. We just all chipped in to buy a birthday present for our school crossing guard. But now you've made it sound like a big underworld swindle. I'm doomed to ride over the back wheels indefinitely. The bus fumes are worse back there, too.
Your program's off the air now, Miss Hillary. When you didn't show up in the studio, they just rebroadcast some old stock market quotations to fill the time.
Worst part was that we only collected 80 cents to buy a present for the school crossing guard, so we had to settle for a secondhand necktie.
Well, Blodgett, you can't measure ruthlessness and evil by the amount of money it brings in. It's just as cruel to rob small children of 80 cents as it is to swindle the whole country out of millions. And as a reporter, I'm pledged to expose corruption in all forms. It's the only way we can maintain our individual freedom and keep Old Glory flying over this wonderful land.
And so Bridget's high journalistic principles have endangered the health of a small boy who may be her only child. But how long can she go on being a reporter first and a mother second? Join us next time when we'll hear Mr. Schlumberger say,
"Give me that quarter. You'll find yourself wearing a cement overcoat, kid."
That's in the next exciting episode of Bridget Hillary and the News.
The rest of the Cross Bronx crowd having a good bit of delay getting away from the GW Bridge and starting eastbound. There was an earlier problem out in the Central Bronx area, but all lanes have been reopened. Just expect delays starting eastbound away from the GW area until you're past the area of about Cortona Park. Okay, Major Deegan, we do have some delays coming off the Deegan, up the ramp to the GW Bridge. The problem is a stalled trailer truck as you go over the Alexander Hamilton Bridge into Manhattan. Try to merge over to your left. The rest of the Major Deegan is in good shape. GW Bridge is okay. On the west side, we're quite good, a good part of the way up. You will meet some minor delays going up through the mid-hundreds, but no problem. Down at the Lincoln Tunnel, an improvement to report. It's still fairly heavy coming out of New York, but now light coming in from the Garden State. And now here's Blodgett and Blodgett.
Come in, 710. Red-green.
What's wrong?
I'm getting in the holiday spirit.
I'd say it's the other way around, George.
Well, I'm scared, Fred. Time is running out. If I don't become a bon voyeur, I'll never get a check to give me what I want for Christmas.
You'll probably get the brush anyway.
But I want my stocking stuffed with English leather. English leather aftershave, cologne, soap on a rope.
Are you sure you can handle all that, George?
If I can't, you fail, Fred.
Did Professor Higgins fail, Eliza?
Did Frankenstein fail the monster?
By George, you've got it.
Will George get a well-filled stocking for Christmas? Who will give it to him and at what price?
And now, Grime, the magic shortening that spreads like lard, invite you to join us for another episode of The Gathering Dust. As As we look in on the Bessinger household today, Red Boiling Springs lawyer Bates is just entering Edna's room.
Oh,
good morning, Edna.
Good morning, Red Boiling Springs lawyer Bates. I'm so glad you've come.
Well, you said it was an emergency, so I got here as quickly as I could. I see you're still bedridden.
Yes, I'm feeling a good deal better, but it's so comfy here under the covers that I figure I'll stay at least a few more months.
Well, I do wish you'd make the effort to get up, Edna. You haven't been down in the village in almost 7 years now.
I figure that when you've seen one village, you've seen them all.
Well, there have been a lot of changes in our little town since you were there last. You wouldn't know the place.
Well, I hear they have parking meters on Main Street now.
Yes, all the way down Main Street and halfway up Maple Avenue.
I think parking meters are nice. They give a street a kind of Christmassy look all year round.
Yes, I suppose they do.
Especially when the time has expired, that little red flag comes up.
And I can tell by the way you're twisting your handkerchief that you didn't call me all the way over here just to talk about parking meters.
No, you're right, Red Boiling Springs lawyer Bates. I've got something pretty important on my mind. I think you know how hard life has been for me since David disappeared.
Well, he didn't exactly disappear, Edna. He's married again, living right up in the next block.
I always tell the twins he disappeared. I think it makes things easier for them.
Twins are almost 40 now, Edna. Don't you think it's about time they knew the truth?
I didn't bring you here to discuss the raising of my children, lawyer Bates. I wanted to talk to you about this house.
That's a lovely old place, Edna. And it's laid out so conveniently with the coal bin right inside the front door.
Yes, I know, but this house has a lot of unpleasant memories for me. It was right down in the parlor that the police shot it out with Daddy.
And what are you trying to say to me?
Lawyer Bates, I want to put the house up for sale.
But, Edna, you don't own this house.
I don't?
No, you just rent a room here. This is Ferguson's boarding house.
Well, Lawyer Bates, you don't know what this news means to me. It's as if I'm free. A great burden has been lifted from my shoulders, and I'm no longer standing in the gathering dust.
Ladies, nobody likes a shortening that's filled with lumps and old pieces of fruit peeling. That's why you go for Grime, the magic shortening that spreads like lard. Try some today and be with us next time when Edna goes to the village in the gathering dusk.
Backstage, Noble Wife, the story of America's favorite family of the Footlights and of their fight for security and happiness against the concrete heart of Broadway. It's a few minutes after yesterday's episode concluded now in the television studio where the Joe Franklin program is being taped. Mary, Harry, Pop, and Calvin are to be Joe's next guests, and as we join the episode, his theme is in progress.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin speaking. Several years ago on my program, I introduced a young acting couple who so impressed me with their talent that I was convinced they were destined to go on to Broadway stardom. Well, they've made it and have since been back here with me several times. Currently starring in a musical production of A Tale of Two Cities, here are the Lunt and Fontaine of their generation, Mary and Harry Baxter, and their friends who co-star with them in the show, Calvin Hoogevan and Pop Beloved.
Oh, that's very nice. Very nice,
Thank
Joe.
Thank you very much, Joe. Those are nice words.
How you doing, Joe?
Well, it's a struggle.
Uh-huh. Oh, we enjoy your program so much, and it's so nice of you to have us here.
Fantastic topic.
Yes, we were kind of surprised that you taped at 4 a.m. Every day, Joe. This is kind of an unusual hour for us to come into the city.
We arrived in the city about 3 a.m., and we walked. Yes, thank you. And we walked slowly up 8th Avenue up to your studio.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Well, at least it did to us. We thought it was the best way to get here, didn't we?
Well, anyway, what'd you think of that hopsicle?
Your old friend and producer, Greg Marlowe, who is secretly in love with Mary backstage, involved in this particular Broadway show?
Sure, he's the producer,
producer,
really.
Yes.
not his money. We have the backing of wealthy Jacobus Pike, of course.
Yes.
But Greg is the producer, and he's still secretly in love with Mary, yes.
I really don't recall any stage productions in recent years of A Tale of Two Cities proportion, much less a musical version.
Yes.
Well, what gave you the idea for this particular show, A Tale of Two Cities?
Well, I forget how it all happened. I think we were reading one of, going through a collection of Dickens' works one night.
Yes.
We'd been drinking, and...
It seemed like a natural thing to do.
It seemed like a good idea, as they say.
Did you like it, Joe, when you saw it? Joe?
I think he drifted off to sleep.
And so our interview begins on the Franklin Show, and we'll continue on Monday, and you want to be here then when we'll hear Joe say...
Have they read the book?
That's Monday in the next exciting episode of Mary Backstage Noble One. Word Carr speaking.